Windows. A Clark Ashton Smith podcast.
When Morgi, the high priest of the goddess Yunde, together with 12 of his most ferocious and efficient underlings, came at morning twilight to seek the infamous heretic Ibon in his house of black gneiss on the headland above the northern main, they were surprised as well as disappointed to find him absent. Their surprise was due to the fact that they had fully thought to take him unaware, for all their tribunals against Ibon had been carried on with meticulous privacy in underground vaults with soundproof bolted doors, and they themselves had made the long journey to his house in a single night, immediately following the hour of his condemnation. They were disappointed because the formidable writ of arrest, with symbolic flame-etched runes on a scroll of human skin, was now useless. And because there seemed to be no early prospect of trying out the ingenious agonies, the intricately harrowing ordeals which they had devised for Ibon with such providential forethought.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to Season 2, Episode 1 of Strange Shadows, the Clark Ashton Smith podcast. The voice you heard there was Shelley DeCruz, reading an excerpt of today's story. I'm one of your hosts, Tim Mendes.
And I'm the other one, Rob Poyton. And in case it's the first time you've joined us, what we're doing is working through the weird fiction of Clark Ashton Smith, and we're using the Nightshade Books 5-volume series as a guide. We're working through story by story, volume by volume. And that that collection is edited by Scott Connors and Ron Hilger. And as much as possible, they've gone for the pure Clark Ashton Smith texts. So I'm delighted to say we're joined by a special guest, friend of the show. It's the return of that ideal exemplar of cephalic evolution, Jeff Goad. Hi, Jeff.
Love it, love it. Hi, thanks for having me on.
Bravo, that was a bit of a mouthful.
Well, even some of the words and names we've got tonight, that was quite an easy one, actually. So
I've been practicing one of them.
Yeah, I'm leaving that to you then.
Nice.
So I think, Jeff, last time you were on, we were talking about naughty monks, I seem to remember.
We were, yeah.
Well, whenever we're talking about Clark Ashton Smith, we're always going to be talking about some naughty something.
That's very true. And Jeff, you're co-host with Hoy of the Appendix N podcast. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, the show is called the Appendix N Book Club, and we go through the books that were listed in the Appendix N, for those of you who don't know what that is. In the 1979 Advanced Dungeons & Dragons Dungeon Master's Guide, there is a list of the books that Gary Gygax, the co-creator of D&D, thinks that you should read for inspiration for your gaming, and books that inspired the creation of Dungeons & Dragons. So we spent about 100 episodes doing exactly that. And since the 100th episode, we've also expanded the scope of the show to just include any show that any book that can inspire your gaming. So now we're covering all kinds of different stuff. But yeah, it's a podcast where me and my buddy Hoy get a special guest from the RPG community, and we all just kind of sit around and casually chat about what our experience was like reading that book, and then we talk about how we can use it in gaming.
Excellent. Yep, it's a real good listen. And even if you're not a gamer, it's a great listen because you really go into quite a lot of depth on the stories and the themes as well.
Yeah, and the gaming side I also think is really helpful for people who are writers as well, because a lot of what we're doing is chatting about world building techniques as well. And sometimes our guests that we have on for the gaming side of the conversation aren't even gamers, they're just writers too, but they're able to chat with us about world building.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's crack into our first story of season two. The title of the second volume of the collection, The Door to Saturn. And shall we start with the publication history, Tim?
The Door to Saturn was completed on July the 26th, 1930. Now, this is probably going to come as no surprise to Mr. Poyton.
I know what you're going to say.
Yeah. Farnsworth Wright rejected it. Not once, not twice, but three times.
Ouch.
Yeah. And as this is one of Smith's personal favourites of his own work, he was really fond of this story. He was a little bit cheesed off, to say the least. We got a nice little quote here from a letter that he sent to H.P. Lovecraft. about he later that basically he's having a rant. The style or lack of it required by nearly all magazine editors would call for a separate treatise. The idea seems to be that everything should be phrased in a manner that will obviate mental effort on the part of the lowest grade moron.
Way to go, Clark.
I was told the other day that my daughter Saturn could be read only with a dictionary. Also, that I would sell more stories if I were to simplify my vocabulary. Oh. But the story found a home in Strange Tales, which basically amused Smith no end. And he noted with irony to August Derleth that he was paid exactly double what Farnsworth Wright would have paid for it.
Ah.
So it all worked out nicely in the end for him.
So financially it actually worked out okay.
Yeah. And it was published in the January 1932 edition of Strange Tales. So there we go.
Most of his stuff seemed to take a little bit of time, didn't it, to get to get published?
Yeah, most of them go through at least a couple of rejections. I think there's only been there's only been two or three stories that have been accepted straight off, and they were the stories that weren't atypically Smith. They were, you know,
he dialed back on the language a little bit in some cases. Yeah. Oh, I just wanted to mention as well that the introduction to this volume is by Tim Powers. It's a very interesting introduction. I'm not going to read through it, but there was one phase that really stood out to me. Was fatal eroticism.
Nice.
Which kind of sums up a lot of Smith's stories.
Well, there's a band name for us already. I've got an album title sorted for later. No. Right.
And if anyone doesn't know, Tim Powers is a great author. I particularly like his books, The Anubis Gates and On Stranger Tides, which was the basis for one of the Pirates of the Caribbean films. Horribly altered, of course, for the film, but excellent books, well worth a read.
And we covered Declare on the Appendix N Book Club.
Ah, right.
That's the only one of his I've read so far.
Yeah. Well, something like The Anubis Gates that's like a time travel going back to Georgian London. That'd be a very interesting game in sort of setup, perhaps that one.
Yeah.
So, shall we move on to our favourite words? I think I found quite a list in this one. Jeff, do you want to lead us off?
Sure. Well, I want to make sure that I say this magniloquently, but...
Bravo.
Nice.
But yes, magniloquently was one of the words I really enjoyed. One of the ones that I liked that has a much lower syllable count is malisons.
Yes.
We get that one early on. Malisons is a great one.
Curses.
Yes.
There was another one. It was like perspicacious or something. I forget what it is now. I can't find it. Yeah. But I'll leave the rest up to you guys.
Yeah, I've got perspicacious, which is quick-witted. Yeah. One of my favorites. I looked it up because I thought it was going to be dirty. Because the phrase was sacerdotal girth. And I was instantly, my mind instantly went to our sister podcast. I was thinking about Dagon Sack. But sacerdotal is not filthy at all. Sacerdotal is relating to priests and the clergy.
There's a couple of words like that. Well, I guess one of the characters is a priest, right? So yeah, I had Stylitian, which is from the Stylites, which were not a backing group on Motown, but were Christian ascetics. So the sort of people who used to sit up on top of a pillar in the desert, that kind of thing. Mm. I also liked desuetude. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, which means a state of disuse. I was totally unfamiliar with that.
Yeah, that was another one that I had.
That's a good one.
I also had, just before your Stilitian, I think it's in the same sentence, was apterus.
Yes.
Which is relating to birds or insects, and it's wingless. So apterous insects.
That's nice. There is also a word in here that is a word we use today in a different way, But at one point in the story, he tells us that the Blemphorims were bisexual, which cracked me up. But then we discovered that in the story, what he means is bisexual is they are both male and female. They have both biological sexes. It does not mean, it's not referring to who they're attracted to.
That reminds me of Tribbles, because didn't McCoy say Tribbles were bisexual?
Indeed.
Reproducing at will or something.
Well, the Tribbles and the Blemphorims can have a great party together.
The trouble with Tribbles and Blemphorims. Yeah.
That story almost writes itself.
It doesn't it just? Yeah.
And I'm going to finish with Orotund. No. Which of a voice is sonorous or bombastic?
Nice. I'm going to finish with one I've heard of before, but I just like to say it because it's one that just rolls off the tongue, which is valoriously. He strode into a room valoriously. Yeah, with sort of with great courage, basically, you know.
I do like that. That's very magniloquent of you.
Yeah.
I don't even know what magniloquent means, but I'm just going to keep saying it.
We were a bit like that last season. I think our favourite word overall was orchidaceous.
Orchidaceous, yeah.
Which just means flamboyant, like an orchid. Yeah. So we've both been shoehorning that in everywhere.
Yeah, and because of Gavin Chappell, one of our other guests, we keep trying to shoehorn the phrase pecuniary depletion into everything we write. I'm in a state of pecuniary depletion. That's the... Yes.
Sadly, that one's all too easy to use.
Isn't it just in this day and age?
Yeah. I remember as a teenager, I encountered the word lugubrious and I didn't know what it meant. And me and my friend Josh decided to use lugubrious as often as we could for a week and then look it up.
That's brilliant.
And then after we looked it up, we saw that it's when something is dark or dismal. So then we decided that lugubriate is a verb to make something goth.
Oh, that's good. Oh, that is good.
So basically, that's what I've been doing all my life, lugubriating. I love it.
Lugubrious. It doesn't... It's funny with some of these words. They don't sound like what they mean, do they?
No. Yeah.
I don't know. I always had an idea of lugubrious as meaning sort of friendly or something.
Yeah.
Oh, see, and I think I thought it was like gloppy.
Hmm.
Yeah, I can see both of those. Yeah, I guess that Rob, you're probably thinking of loquacious, aren't you? Sort of chatty.
Yeah,
it does sound quite similar, doesn't it?
Something along those lines. Yeah. Well, there we go. We're doing our bit to improve the vocabulary of of the world and bring back some of these words. As we know, Smith just read dictionaries and the like, and just memorized things basically. I think was it in our last patron episode we were talking about the crosswords that he used to put together.
Yes,
with even more obscure words than these.
Yeah, and in the appendices in what the second volume of Dawnward Spire, Lonely Hill, the letters with Lovecraft, they've got reprints of all these crosswords that he used to make. There's about 30 of them, and yeah. It's like that some of the words, it's like 15 syllables, you know. It's just like, what?
So, the daughter Saturn, we're back in Hyperborea.
Yeah.
Love this story.
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah.
So good.
My favorite mythos deity puts in an appearance, you know. It's always a happy day when you get the old sleepy toad god putting in an appearance.
And there's so many nice little touches in this story, and we've got two main characters. We've got Ibon, the wizard who wrote the Book of Ibon, which obviously features in a lot of mythos stories. And we've got his nemesis, Morgi, the high priest of the goddess Yunde, who's is kind of like a sort of head of the Inquisition sort of guy. That's the feeling.
Yeah, I get that. It's sort of like, you know, the stormtroopers of the church kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
And they're coming for Ibon, basically. They're storming Ibon's tower. And they want to take him and question him. Well,
yes,
by questioning him, we mean torture him, really, don't we?
Yeah, I love this line here, right at the start. I mean, you get some great world building to begin with, but talking about them when they come in and they obviously burst into his chamber and he's gone. and they've been watching the place for ages, but he's nowhere to be seen. And there's this lovely line. They were disappointed because the formidable writ of arrest with symbolic flame-etched runes on a scroll of human skin was now useless. I mean, that just says all you need to know about these guys, doesn't it? They're hardcore, these fellas, you know.
Yes, they are.
And this is Smith again, just world-building with a couple of sentences and everything. Because straight away, you can picture these guys in there, probably like red cowls or whatever they've got, you know.
And also he tells us that the House of Abon is a pentagonal tower with five stories, including the two that are underground. So I'm like, okay, so does that mean that it's only three stories above ground? Like, that doesn't sound like a very menacing tower. But then they talk about how when you step out of the tower, there's like a 400-foot drop to the sea.
Yeah. So I
don't know. I was having hard to, no, they're just really high ceilings or...
like a lighthouse or something.
Yeah, I guess it's on a headland, isn't it?
It's probably built over the cliff, like... sort of hanging over the cliff edge, maybe, but then underground and right next to the cliff does sound a bit odd, doesn't it? But I did think again with a lot of this story, this is pure D&D, you know, especially the start of it, raiding the wizard's tower.
Oh yeah. And you think you've planned this so well, and you're going to catch the wizard red-handed, and nope, where is he?
Yeah.
And the other thing I liked with this was. All their tribunals against Ibon have been carried out with meticulous privacy in underground vaults with soundproof bolted doors. It's the amount of secrecy they've gone to, because I suppose most wizards, they're going to have eyes and ears everywhere kind of thing, especially if there's an inquisition about.
Yeah.
So the lengths they've gone to hide their plans was quite amusing.
But poor Morgi probably doesn't realize that a locked door doesn't protect from Abon's scrying.
There you go.
Yes.
Well, it turns out he had a tip and a wink from his deity, didn't it? That's how he did it coming.
That's right.
So I like that.
Yeah, and this is the nice thing with this, because, I mean, Sothogir is actually a character in this.
Mm.
You know, there's dialogue. And I think, as we said before, he seems to be one of the few mythos deities that you can have quite a cozy chat with.
Yeah. Well, it's like the seven Gaiuses, isn't it? Well, which we'll be covering at some point. It's like, it's just like, he actually seems like quite a nice chap for a big furry winged toad, you know? It's just like, you know what? I can't be bothered to eat you today. It's just like, just shut the door when you leave. It's fine. He's quite chilled, this guy, you know?
And that's also why they're raiding him, right? Because they think he's getting his secret dark powers from Sothogir. Rather than worshipping the proper gods, the goddess Yunde, who's, I think she's described as an elk goddess.
Yep, she is.
Yeah, I got a vision of sort of big sort of antlers or something going on. I'm not quite sure.
And the timing's perfect because Yellow Jacket Season 2 starts streaming as of today. And we've got our big elk cult leader with the big elk headdress on in that.
right.
Nice.
But what's funny is they're going after him because I believe they started a rumor that he is worshiping Sothogir, and lo and behold, the rumor they started is absolutely true.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. These rumors were that Ebon was a devotee of the long discredited heathen god Sothogir, whose worship was incalculably older than man, and that his magic was drawn from his unlawful affiliation with this dark deity who had come down by way of other worlds from a foreign universe in primeval times when the earth was still no more than a steaming morass. Nice. Some places are still a steaming morass, if you ask me.
Well, I was going to say, yeah. And we get quite a lot of backstory for Sothogir on this as well. And we also meet some of his relations, which is quite...
Indeed, we do, yeah.
So they search the tower. They're looking for Ibon. There's no sign of him. But they do find evidence of Sothogir worship.
And they start pulling down a bunch of paintings from the wall.
Yeah, So this is just like D&D again, isn't it? Or you know, your spot hidden role and that kind of stuff, secret passages...
They're pulling down tapestries, pulling down paintings, when lo and behold, they find a strange panel, reflective panel, high up on the wall of the uppermost floor.
Yeah, it kind of put me in mind of like a sort of plasma screen or something like that. Like they used to have in Star Trek, didn't they? You know, all those colors going on it.
I just pictured a big medicine cabinet.
I love this line here. Though Morgie had even gone as far as to remove the flagstones beneath an obscene image of Zonagoa. He's really gone for it, hasn't he? He's gone to town. He's even digging the floor up.
He's determined to find something, isn't he? And they torture the servants as well with boiling asphalt or something.
Yes, indeed. Great. A slow drip of boiling asphaltium. Yeah.
Yeah, then Morgie climbs up and opens up that panel, and on the other side is not the sea in the sky that he was expecting to see on the other side. It said beyond it, Morgie saw that there was neither sea nor sky, nor in fact anything he had seen or heard of or ever dreamed of in his most outrageous nightmares. ..
Nice. There's another great little touch here that the paintings, these gruesome paintings that he's been thrown to the floor, were actually painted on the pterodactyl parchment.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Isn't that great? Yeah. I'd love a pair of pterodactyl parchment shoes, I think. Imagine that. So, of course, he goes through. And he doesn't even really stop to think about this, does he? He just seems to dive headfirst through, says to his acolytes, "Oh, I'll be back," and then dives through this interplanetary portal.
And then suddenly we get a flashback, and we get to hang out with Abon and learn about how we got to where we are from Abon's perspective.
Yeah, and this is where we start getting Sarthogua's backstory about he came to Earth from the planet Sikranosh, which is actually Saturn, or that's what they call Saturn in Muthulan, where we are at the moment. But that itself had been merely a way station in his travels from remoter worlds and systems.
Mm.
So we get something of his background, but we still don't really know his actual origin.
Yeah, I like the fact that as a special reward after years of service and burnt offerings, he presented to Abon a large, thin, oval plate of some ultra-telluric metal. And this is obviously the door that he did a runner through, and that his nemesis has just gone after him. Mm-hmm. The panel, if swung outward from the wall on open air, would have the peculiar property of giving admittance to the world of Sikranosh, many million miles away in space.
And he warns him that this is kind of like a last ditch.
Yeah, this is a one-way ride.
Yes, it's quite a bit of foresight on Sarthogua's. Well, I guess maybe he has the power of foresight or prophecy or something. And he obviously favours Ibon to give him this escape route.
Yeah. And also, this isn't the first gift he's given to Ibon, because it also says earlier on that that Ibon had made sacrifices that were most acceptable, and the strange, sleepy little god, in return for Abon's interest and his devotion, had confided to him certain information that was more than useful in the practice of the black arts. So it's also just fun that, like, he was basically like running little errands for him and giving him little sacrifices. And in exchange, like, Sarthogua is just kind of like whispering like black magic secrets in his ear.
I've got sort of visions of him and maybe, you know, scratching Sarthogua's back. Oh, just up there, just by my shoulder. Yeah, just there.
just by the wing. Yeah.
Or maybe chewing on an arm or something.
Yeah.
But he also tells them about on Saturn, he actually has some relatives.
Indeed, yeah.
And he gives him sort of some names, so if he does go there, he'll be able to, ingratiate himself with the locals.
Including the almost unpronounceable name of the most powerful of these deities.
Yes, and we're going to find out just how almost unpronounceable that is later on.
I've been practicing. You've
been doing sort of vocal gymnastics in the.
I have been practicing. I'll probably still make a hash of it.
There's a patron in DCC named Babugbabills, and this one definitely makes Babugbabills seem much easier to pronounce.
Wow, you said that very well, sir.
Yeah.
So, yes, we get the experience of Ibon going through the panel now. And Ibon saw that the Sarthogua was indeed a god of his word. For the scene beyond the panel was nothing that could ever find a legitimate place in the topography of Muthulan or of any terrestrial region. It didn't altogether appeal to him, but there was no alternative, save the inquisitorial cells of the goddess Yunde. So, faced with torture and a long lingering death, he's gone through to Saturn.
And the first thing he sees is a stream of liquid mercury.
Yes. And this is that nice, I mean, we go back to the abominations of Yondo and the story set on Venus. It's not just a little bit different.
Yeah.
It's not kind of Star Trek, the sky's a different color, is it?
Yeah. It's not Vasquez Rocks, is it? It's all that, well, that quarry in Dorset where all Doctor Who was filmed.
Exactly. You're an alien because you have a wrinkled forehead.
No, these things don't even have foreheads or heads.
Yeah, and he starts walking, and there are these objects that he sees everywhere that he's not sure if they're trees, mineral forms, or animal organisms, and then ultimately decides that they are some kind of combination of all three.
Yeah, I really like that, because that really is alien, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, animal, mineral, vegetable, or all of the above. Yeah, it's.
And I also like the fact that we had the greenish black sky that was overarched from end to end with a triple cyclopean ring of dazzling luminosity.
Ooh.
So that really sets it on Saturn, doesn't it?
That's some prime Smith wordplay there, isn't it? You know.
Triple cyclopean. I don't think even Lovecraft hit a triple cyclopean, did he?
I don't think he did. I bet Lovecraft punched the air when he read this, didn't he?
That's like 180, isn't it? That's
a triple cyclopean. It's a bullseye,
yeah. One-upping his cyclopean.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, mine's triple cyclopean. Yeah, well, mine's Infinity Cyclopean.
Mega. Yeah, where do we go? Mega Cyclopean. Yeah, I guess Infinity Cyclopean.
Yeah. It's the thing when you're a kid, isn't it? Oh, I hate you a billion. I hate you a billion, billion, million.
So he sets off down this slope as he's going past these strange cacti, bluish obsidian cacti things with limbs and heads that were altogether too elaborate for fruits or blossoms. So again, the idea of, is it a plant? Is it an animal? And he comes to a lake.
Oh, also, and they communicate with a faint and singular tinkling with many modulations of tone, which I just thought was a really interesting detail to put in about these obsidian cacti.
Yeah, it's a nice touch. It's a nice touch again.
Yeah, he felt as though they were talking about him as he was walking past.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're probably saying, what the hell is that horrible-looking thing?
Brings to mind the sort of gamelan and that kind of musical discipline, doesn't it? All the different bells and percussion are like hanging up. And I did a course on that when I was at college, and you can get some really unreal-sounding soundscapes just by randomly whacking things and moving things about, and I can hear it in my head when I'm reading this. It's great, really nice touch.
And also thinking back to the original Star Trek, often you had, when they beam down, there was kind of a sort of high-pitched noise in the background, and in some planets you'd have that sort of tinkling thing going on, didn't you? So I do wonder, because what was the story we read that spoke about boldly going where no adventurers had been before? Roddenberry must have been a Clark Ashton Smith fan. I'm sure of it.
That was the Venus one, wasn't it? With the what was it?
5-year mission.
Yeah, the devouring thing, the big shockothy thing, and I forget the name of it on the top of my head. The Immeasurable Horror.
Yes,
that was it. That was it. It even had a red shirt in it.
Yes, it did.
Yeah.
And this reminded me a bit of the Abominations of Yondo, because he comes to these steps that lead down to a lake. And as he's approaching it, the shadow of something large falls across him.
Mm.
And I like that it has a pendulous form. Or no, what does it say? A sleeping-looking head that was pendulous from a spherical body as if it were turning a somnambulistic somersault.
Somnambulistic somersault.
That's my album title I was going to mention.
It sounds like something Genesis would have put out, doesn't it?
It does a little bit, doesn't it? Yeah.
Who did Tales from Topographical Oceans? Was that Yes? Oh, Yes or someone?
Yes, that was Yes. I'm pretty sure that was Yes. It sounds like Yes. It sounds like Rick Wakeman disappearing up his own backside, doesn't it?
Now, Tim, are you vocally warmed up? Do you want to do a bit of a light stretching or anything before we... So he sees this thing and he thinks, well, this must be related to Zathogua because of the furriness and the somnolent expression. And so he's trying to recall the name that that had been confided to him by the god as a sort of password.
Indeed.
And this thing sort of ignores him, really. It just goes down to the lake and starts drinking. And I love the fact that he thought, because it's drinking what looks like mercury, this is obviously a god. This is obviously not just an animal. The fact that it can drink mercury shows that it must be a god. So he calls its name out.
Indeed. Indeed he does.
Stand well back.
Here we go. Zilkoig Menza.
Oh, that's not bad.
Zilkoig Menza. Menza.
That's good going.
There you go. We'll go with that.
I like that line. Ibon did the best he could with the vocal organs at his command. Because that ties us right into our Lovecraft, doesn't it?
Yeah.
With even Cthulhu, these names that are not meant to be uttered by human vocal cords.
And then the thing even deigned to utter something which sounded like an attempt to correct his pronunciation.
Yeah, I love that. It's like, you got it wrong, you numpty.
And then he gives him this phrase. Right, okay, shall I have a go at this one?
Yeah, go on, you can do that one.
Finally, it raised one of its L-long arms from the ground and pointed along the shore where the mouth of a low valley was discernible among the hills. It said distinctly the enigmatic words, Ichwidlosh Odlonkra.
Nice. Nice.
And then while the sorcerer was pondering the significance of this unusual locution, it turned away from him and started to reascend the higher steps. So he's been given this phrase.
And then Morgi appears. Detestable sorcerer,
yes.
Abominable heretic, I arrest you.
I love it. Said Morgi with pontifical severity.
It's good, isn't it? Pontifical severity.
Love it.
But
love
he sees that Morgi's on his own, so he smiles and gets his sword out, his highly tempered bronze sword.
Yeah, I love his response here. I should advise you to moderate your language, Morgi.
Also, your idea of arresting me is slightly out of place now.
Yeah, we're millions of miles away from Muthulan. And he sort of says that he's been conversing with one of the gods of Sikranosh, and that the god has given him a mission to perform, a message to deliver. That's his interpretation of the events. These three words are obviously of great import and need to be told to someone or something.
And one of my favorite moments in this story is when he says, Morgi was unwillingly impressed.
Yes. How many times in your life have you been unwillingly impressed?
Okay,
it's quite
fine.
A few, isn't it? It is fine. Yeah, yes. All right. You were right.
I guess that is really cool, and I hate that it is, but okay.
Yeah. That's the one.
But I don't know if Morgi is a very cool character or he's just a bit dim. I suspect it may be the latter, because he seems to take no account of the fact that he's now on Saturn. He's gone through this gateway and he's on another planet, and it just doesn't seem to really register with him.
But again, it's that monomania that a lot of Smith's characters have. You see that a lot in Smith's characters, these people who are so focused on one thing. Like Murder in the Fourth Dimension is another great example. A very similar sort of character. He's so wrapped up in this, I'm going to kill this guy. All this weird stuff's going on around him, but it doesn't get through the red mist almost,
And he just sort of brushes it off as some sort of wizardry or sorcery or something. Perhaps he thinks it's an illusion, maybe.
Yeah. Well, he actually says, I suppose this is some more of your damnable wizardry. So,
and this is jumping ahead a little bit, but also it's like how near the end of the story when they're hanging out with the Yadeens and they're both kind of getting sick of living with the Yadeens, and Morgi's issue with the Yadeens is that they are religious, but they're not so devoted that they're like bigots and intolerant, so it was impossible for him to start an inquisition with them.
Oh, wasn't that lovely, wasn't it?
Yeah, I love it. Yeah.
And this really is Smith again on religious intolerance, isn't it? I mean, that just runs through the whole thing. Yeah, but imagine being disappointed that people aren't willing to torture other people in the name of their religion.
Mm-hmm.
Well, sadly, all too true.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's.
So that gets us into chapter three, and they start their wanderings now. They've got a direction to go in, and we start getting descriptions of the scenery. And they find a road, and the road is full of large footprints, all of them circular in form and rimmed about with the marks of protruding claws. And I really like this next creature that they come across as well.
Can I pause real quick before we go to the next creature? In the previous paragraph, is probably my favorite line in this whole story. The hills were lapsing gently to a well-wooded plain whose flora would have been the despair of earthly botanists. I love the idea of their flora being the despair of earthly botanists.
Nice.
It's like that could mean so many things. Is it their despair because the flora on here is so magnificent that it makes ours look so lame? Or is it like, or does it just expand the idea of what flora is to the point where like our sciences on this planet mean nothing? And now you realize that you've devoted your life to studying something that you can't even possibly comprehend. The idea of this being the despair of earthly botanists is just so fascinating to me. And it's just kind of like a throwaway line that I just think is so delicious.
It is part of that world building skill he has again, where with just a little phrase like that, there are so many implications.
Yeah.
And you feel like you could almost, like all these books, you could get build a novel out of this.
Yeah. You know? Absolutely.
And it's like at the end of this same paragraph, you get even more sort of like about these plants, and it gives you sort of wonder, but it also makes you wary as well, which I think is a great skill that he has. They lined the way with serrate branches that were like sheaves of darts and daggers, of sword blades and needles. So there you go. These are plants you do not mess with. These plants will mess you up.
So they continue along this road, they find these footprints, and then they come across the creature that's making these footprints, which is this vast sort of, almost sounds like armor plated thing. And it's so big they can't see the front of it, it's just blocking the whole road. And is this another of your gods, asked Morgi with attempted irony, which makes it sound like it wasn't quite successful irony perhaps. And Ibon's response is to call out that name again, which I'm not even going to attempt.
Zilquig Minza.
There you go.
There you go. I'm getting it again now.
You could have a tattoo.
In a heart. A green heart. Yeah.
And a nice little sathoga on the other arm. But he walks up to this thing and basically pokes it in the arse with his sword, which is such a mad thing to do.
This is why I can't help but see that Ebon as British, because that's the British chap thing with the walking cane, isn't it? Move along, Greg. Go on. Move along.
And just sort of saying the same word, but probably a bit louder each time. It's the standard.
Yes. Yeah. In tweed robes.
And then it gets up and it starts walking, and he starts following it.
Yes, for miles and miles.
For hours, yeah.
Through the forest, which is still this high wall of sharp metallic foliage, but other roads and paths now start branching off. And then there's a sudden clamour of deep and booming voices that rose from somewhere in advance of the monster. A veritable tintamarre of unhuman guttural bellowings and croakings, with notes that were somehow suggestive of reproof or objurgation, like shrewish drums, as if the monster were being scolded. So it's almost, I imagine this thing as sort of, I don't know, a big, slow, dumb thing, probably just chewing the cud as it goes.
Like a cow, I see it as sort of like a Saturn's equivalent of a big daft heifer.
Yeah, and it's just blocking the M25 at the moment.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
It's getting out people, the bloody way.
Yeah, they're honking the horns at it.
Yeah, and in the next section, they basically say that too. They say the monster, which was plainly of a tame and harmless and stupid sort, was cowering before a knot of beings no larger than men, who were armed only with long-handled goads.
Ooh, ooh.
And as somebody whose last name is Goad, I find that especially entertaining.
Are you the long-handled goad? Or are you
the short-handled? That's a very personal question.
we are talking Smith here, so... Yeah, and this is where we get to meet the main denizens of this area.
Who are quite embarrassed by the fact that they no longer have heads. Their heads and their bodies have kind of melded into one. But this is not something that they are comfortable with. This is something that they are indeed deeply ashamed about.
And I love this, that they have ears, eyes, nostrils, mouths in some sort of arrangement or combined in one. And certain other organs of doubtful use. Wholly naked, rather dark in colour, with no trace of hair. Behind them at a little distance were many edifices of a kind which hardly conformed to human ideas of architectural symmetry. So there's our non-Euclidean stuff, I guess.
Indeed, yeah.
And I think you're right, Tim. I think Ibon must be British, because what does he do? He just strides up to them, waving his stick and starts shouting at them.
Shouts out those same words he's been saying to everybody else. I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah. Hang out with us.
Yes, he tries the Icky Dosh Ondelong phrase as well.
Indeed.
They bow. They drop their goads and they bow before him.
And then I love that after this, they just hang out with them for several Circonosian months.
Yeah, as honored guests of this quaint and worthy and virtuous people who called themselves the Blefroims. Blemfroims? Yeah. Blemfroims.
Yeah. Yes, I've been saying Blemfroims.
Blemfroims, Blemfrims. Yeah, yeah. Either or, I think. Tomato, tomato, isn't it?
And the name of the town is Vlor.
I've got to wonder how much, like, this was a game of one-upmanship with Lovecraft and Smith. Because you'll notice that as this, their stories progressed, like during their friendship, the names and things got more and more outlandish with each story. It was like, oh, I see your hithum scums blah blah blah, and I raise you a shlub blah blah blah. You know,
I think Smith is definitely head on point.
Oh God, yeah.
So yeah, they, like you say, they hang out with these people for quite a while. And what have we got? They're living on edible fungi. There's the breeding of large centipedal animals going on, and the propagation of their own species. This is where we get the bisexual references. But there's only one female in a generation chosen for reproductive duties. And this female, after growing to mammoth size on food prepared from a special fungus, became the mother of an entire new generation. And I think at this point we start to get an idea of where this story is going.
And now we know we're definitely in a Clark Ashton Smith novel. As he begins to describe, the sorcerer and the inquisitor were impressed, even if not captivated, by the mountainous amplitude of her charms and by their highly novel arrangement.
Yes, indeed. Again, my mind goes to Carry On Up the Jungle, because you got that thing again where they're captured and they're taken to this village and they're brought out and they've got to perform for these huge Amazonian women. And they're all worn out and knackered and want to escape. They think it was a great thing to end up at this camp to begin with, but, you know, novelty quickly wears off.
Because here comes along these two people who have necks and heads, and it's like, we need those again. It's been a long time since we've had necks, and they even described their eugenic sorrow.
That's quite almost a sinister phrase, isn't it? Eugenic sorrow.
It is.
That's potentially quite dark. That.
Another band name.
Like Joy Division.
Yeah, exactly. Eugenic sorrow.
And despite all this strangeness, or maybe because of it, they do start to get a bit bored. Two humans. Well, they're basically living on fungus, boiled or roasted mushrooms, varied only by the coarse and flabby meat of tame monsters, which doesn't sound very appetizing. And the people, although we had all this bowing at the start, don't seem to be particularly awed by them, not even awed by the exhibitions of Hyperborean magic with which Ibon and Morgi favoured them. And their lamentable want of religious ardour made all evangelistic endeavour thankless task. So unlike the lot we meet later, these aren't even really particularly religious, it seems. Let alone inquisitorial.
Their souls are doomed.
But then we get the good news. There's been a committee meeting.
And we have decided you get to mate with the big mama. Yeah. And even better news, she gets to eat you afterwards.
Yeah.
What a great honor. You should be really pleased.
That's when I heard Monty Python in my head. Run away!
Well, this was my favourite line in the story. Thinking of the mountainous female they had seen, Morgi was prone to remember his sacerdotal vows of celibacy, and Ibon was eager to take similar vows upon himself without delay.
Nice.
As much as I'd like to mate with your huge mother of the tribe, I've taken a vow of celibacy. It's like, so have I.
And then speaking of just like brilliant world building, I love that the Blumferims just cannot conceive of the possibility that somebody wouldn't be so highly honored to do this that they don't even think to monitor them. And the guys are just like, yeah, you want to just leave? Yeah, let's leave. They just walk away.
They do. That's it. They're
yeah.
There's no big like rescue in the middle of the night or like escape in the middle of the night. They just saunter off.
Yeah, and they're not even followed, I don't think, are they? The Grim don't even follow them. And they've heard about this place called the Land of the Yetims, which was many leagues away. And it's a bit of a journey, right? They've got to go across deserts and mountains and fungoid forests to get there.
Yeah, more cacti, more fungus.
And again, we get a nice description of these various little things that they see on the way.
And one of the first things they see, I love the way they describe it. The gibbies, the Apterius and Stylitean bird people who roost on their individual dolomites for years at a time and meditate upon the cosmos, uttering to each other at long intervals the mystic syllables yop, yeep, and yoop, which are said to express an unfathomable range of esoteric thought.
That's
marvelous. So good.
I'm going to do that next time I'm feeling a bit esoteric. Yum, yeep, yoop. Yep.
Climb up a lamppost.
Sit cross-legged on a lamppost, yeah.
But it's interesting that we get told that. Do they know that? Or, again, this is almost like a narrator's voice. I'm getting almost like a Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy kind of feel for that.
Well, definitely the narrative focus shifts a lot in this story. First it's from Morgi's perspective, then it's kind of more from Abon's perspective, but then it's also kind of this, like, I don't know, omniscient narrator who's just kind of observing.
And we hear about the underground croaking of that mysterious people, the Glongs, who dread not only the sunlight, but also the ring light, and who have never yet been seen by any of the surface dwellers. So they see things or don't see things that have not even been seen and are not even described. Again, it's that tantalizing glimpse of something going on, and that's it. That's all we get to hear about.
Yeah.
And we encounter the term Fliberty Gibbet in that paragraph as well.
Yes, the ethics.
Yeah. Who hollow out their homes in the trunks of certain large fungi and are always having to hunt new habitations because the old ones crumble into powder in a few days. That must be a pain in the backside, isn't it? You get yourself a nice pad, settle in. Ah, crap, it's already started to crumble.
I've rented flats like that when I lived in London.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Talk about fungus.
Yeah.
But from a gaming perspective, we get enough world building in this that you can create like a campaign box set based on just this short story.
Yeah, I was going to say from a gaming point of view, this is, well, we've gone from that assault on the Wizard's Tower to a wilderness sort of trek or campaign now, haven't we?
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's so many different species and not just about flora and fauna. It's just, yeah. You could have some real fun with this, couldn't you? Writing a campaign.
But it's like it gives you enough detail to place the things, but not so much detail that you... It gives you a lot of scope as a DM or a GM, I imagine, to work with these ideas. You know, you're not just tied to orcs, goblins, it's a troll. You know, you could be really creative with this kind of thing. So they get to the mountains, the last barrier they have to overcome before reaching safety. And Ivan's all right because he's quite wiry and slender. But Morgai, this is where he has his sacerdotal girth and bulk, and he's soon winded. And whenever he paused to recover his breath, Ibon would say to him, "Think of the National Mother."
I love the fact that it describes him as well, that Morgai would climb the next acclivity like an agile but somewhat asthmatic mountain sheep.
That is so good.
It's brilliant.
And this next part really reminds me of if we were playing in the box set for this setting, your random encounter generator is going to be two columns where you roll on the adjective and then you roll on the noun. And the thing that we randomly rolled here was fungus avalanche. The GM just has to figure out, like, okay, how do I make a fungus avalanche work? Oh, I've got an idea. And then we have this next scene.
That's great. Yeah.
Rolling puffballs and toppling toadstools. Brilliant.
Sounds like a Batman thing. Toppling toadstools, Batman.
Rolling puffballs, Batman.
Easy there, Robin.
Oh, nice.
Yes, and that sort of helps them down the other side, doesn't it, really?
It's quite, yeah.
And then we're into the final chapter, where they're now in the land of the Hedims, and the avalanche has pretty much sort of buried the town.
It just kind of carried them into town, yeah. Yeah. And then immediately they're just like, "Hearken, we are here. We have arrived on our avalanche."
Again, it's a very British thing, isn't it? I'm like, "Huzzah, we are here. We're going to plant a flag." You know,
it also feels like a very American thing, too. You're yeah. not. The American is here.
We've got a flag. Yes, but this is our country. Yeah. Do you have a flag?
Yeah, exactly.
We have a flag.
And again, he comes out with that icky doulash oobleong. It's oolong? It sounds like a tea.
Yeah, and that gets a result with these people again as well, because they bring out a huge image of HZ, and smaller icons of lesser, though allied deities. And a very ancient-looking idol, which both Ibon and Morgai recognised as having resemblance to Sothogua.
So, yeah, they're soggy.
Yeah. This could have been the place he was hanging out before he came to Earth, I guess, or something.
Yeah, and the Yadim start bringing out their household goods, furniture, basically moving out. And, accompany the two wizards and go on their merry way.
Yes, and they finally learn the meaning of Ikwi Dlosh Udlong.
Love this.
Which is not some great mystical utterance or some highly spiritual secret. It just really means be on your way.
I absolutely love it. That all the way along they've thought that this was this profound phrase. It was basically old Huzzy telling him, "Do one." It was just like, "Go away."
And that's just such typical Smith, isn't it, really? And I suppose Lovecraftian in the sense that humans put importance on these things that are actually totally irrelevant and meaningless.
Yeah.
Meaningless.
And the Yadims, because it is accompanied by them showing up on an avalanche, actually do think that this is some kind of a great message. The avalanche comes down, and then these guys show up and say, "Be on your way." And they're like, "Okay, I guess we'll evacuate town."
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. So, in a sense, it did have some meaning, I suppose, in a funny way.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much it. They settle into life with the Udims. There's no national mother. The Udims propagate themselves in a far more general manner. So, we're just back to basic rumpy pumpy. And Ibon is kind of okay with this.
Yeah.
Because he sets himself up as a minor prophet because he came delivering this message and is familiar with Sarthogua. Morgi is not so happy because then we get that, as Jeff pointed out, that idea that although these people are religious, they're quite happy for other people to be other religions or non-religious.
I just can't get these guys to persecute other people. What's wrong with them?
Come on, can't we just at least burn a couple of people or something?
Have you ever heard of a witch? Let me tell you about witches.
He doesn't have a book with him. See, yeah. If he'd have brought a book, then that would have made all the difference.
Yeah. Then you get some classic Smith here. But still, there were compensations. The fungus wine of the Adeems was potent, though evil-tasting, and there were females of a sort, if one were not too squeamish. Absolute brilliance.
Isn't it lovely the way he puts those two together?
Yeah.
You knock back a few mugs of the foul but potent wine, and then, you know, maybe things don't look so bad.
Hit the bed springs, yeah.
If you squint.
Yeah. It's beer goggles, isn't it? It's your beer goggles.
Yeah, it's your beer goggles, yeah. and that's pretty much it. We just finished with this final paragraph where it cuts back to the guys in the tower who wait for days, neither daring to follow the high priest through the magic panel nor daring to leave in despite of his orders. And the interesting thing, the ironic twist at the end, is this whole episode kind of boosts Ibon's reputation. I think he's escaped by powerful magic that he learned from Sarthogua, and that actually means that people start to turn away from Yunde, and there's a big revival in the dark worship of Sarthogua. So the Morgi's mission is totally screwed in every respect.
Yep, completely backfires.
Yeah, it's a win for the toad.
What also kind of cracks me up about this story is it feels a little bit like I'm reading a choose your own adventure and I made the wrong choice and I'm turning to the page where like my character is going to die in this really weird way, or I'm just like abandoned or stuck somewhere. And this is just a much longer version of that one page end of my character.
Because it's quite an abrupt ending in a way, isn't it? We've had quite a lot of detail, and then it's just almost like, and they live there sort of happily ever after. That's it.
Yeah.
They're almost like this weird odd couple, aren't they, at the end? These two, you can imagine them having a 1970s sitcom, you know, in these two guys trying to get along with the locals, you know.
And they lived happily ever after was basically such were the various adventures and such was the final lot of this redoubtable pair in Cirkenosh.
Yeah, I wonder if he was leaving it a little bit open for a sequel. I wonder if he ever thought in those terms, because Ibon's been in a couple of stories, right?
Yeah.
Pops up a couple of times. So I just wonder if at some point there was going to be the return of Ibon or something.
Well, I guess you don't want to kill him off if, because by now, I guess people had sort of latched onto the book more so than the actual wizard. You know, the lever to Ibon had been in several mythos stories by this point, hadn't it? So, you know, made sense to keep the old chap alive.
But yes, this is certainly top tier Smith. I think beautiful language, beautiful phrases, and again, one of those stories that you're never quite sure where it's going.
Yes, and the humor is there. The I don't know if I want to say perversity. I don't know what the word I'm looking for is, but
fruitiness.
I guess I'll use that word. But what was
fruitiness?
Sure.
Fruitiness of M. Smith.
I just think that he really leans into like the darkly sexual while also being very funny.
Well, it is that fatal eroticism, isn't it, that Tim Powers mentioned at the start?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think this is, if you wanted to, if somebody was like, if I have to read a Clark Ashton Smith story, what should I read? There's no one right answer, but this is a right answer.
Yes. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So we know that this was one of Smith's favourites. And there's not a lot of mention of it in the letters between Smith and Lovecraft. We do get a couple of fairly brief mentions. So this is Smith to Lovecraft, July the 30th, 1930. I'm sending you one of them along with Andromeda and will mail the others presently. You will note that in this one, the daughter Saturn, Sarthogua is brought in under the name of Zarthagua, by which he was known in Muthulan, ancient Greenland. So that's pretty much it. Again, that fills in a little bit more of the background. Now we know that Muthulan is Greenland.
Yeah, I've got a nice little bit of a letter between to August Derleth from September the 15th, 1931. He goes, I guess I told you that Daughter Saturn was one of Wright's rejections. The manuscript was so battered from travel that Bates asked me to tell him, for his own edification, what reasons other editors had given for turning it down. I have the impression you saw the story, but I'm not sure. It was about a Hyperborean sorcerer who, when hotly pressed by the local Grand Inquisitor, vanished through a magic panel to the planet Saturn. The Inquisitor followed him, and the two, finding themselves isolated in an alien world with no possibility of return, agreed to halve their differences and form a sort of alliance. They had a number of curious and diverting adventures among the Saturnian peoples and ended up in a joint ecclesiastical sincere. The tale is one of my own favourites, partly on account of its literary style.
And Lovecraft makes a nice observation here as well. This is from Yuggoth in the Hour of the Black Moon, 6th of August 1930. Your new tale is surely a winner and ought to meet with a warm welcome wherever it goes. I was glad to make good old Sarthogua's acquaintance again, and I think the Saturnian wanderings of your heroes are delightfully handled. The ironic note suggests the tradition of Gulliver, or of Anatole France. So yeah, I never thought like Gulliver's Travels. That does fit quite well, doesn't it?
Mm.
And then we get one more mention. This is Smith to Lovecraft, and this is in December 1930, and I'm going to read the return address on this one because it's one of those good ones again. From the sacrificial altar of the nameless gods that were and are and shall be in the space beyond space and the time beyond time. And yes, indeed, brilliant. One could write numerous reams on the subject of style. The style or lack of it required by nearly all magazine editors would call for a separate treatise. And then it's that one you mentioned earlier about this idea that if he wanted to be a more successful writer, basically he's got to dumb down, which I suppose is that's the struggle of every artist with the mainstream, isn't it? You know, every true
artist. Yeah, it is, yeah. It's like musicians selling out, isn't it? It's, you know.
Yeah, or Van Gogh turning out perhaps some nice pictures of horses or something.
Yeah.
I agree, and I will lightly push back against some of that, because I also think sometimes really brilliant things come from that kind of conflict with the mainstream. Like, I think about Twin Peaks, for example. Like, David Lynch, when he's completely unhinged, I love it. It's not for everybody.
Yes.
When David Lynch got together with Mark Frost and had to make a lot of creative sacrifices to make something that could be aired on, I forget if it's ABC or CBS, Twin Peaks happened, and Twin Peaks is phenomenal. So I also think sometimes cool things can happen from that. But if you want like the artist's true vision, yeah, you're not going to get that without compromise. You're not going to, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And again, that could be the thing, that element of compromise is what makes it accessible. Sometimes, perhaps, because again, what's the line between self-indulgence and genius or creativity? Yeah. And you know, it's interesting how that works.
Well, it's like one of the favorite lines I've ever heard about jazz was a musician friend of mine. He goes, "Yes, there's a fine line between art and wank." You know, it's true, isn't it?
Well, that's why I can never... I mean, even things like Miles Davis or something are not really my cup of tea. I can't find a way into it.
No, it's kind of inaccessible, isn't it?
And that's probably a failing on my part in that respect. But
horses for courses, isn't it? It's whatever floats your boat.
Yeah,
exactly. I don't think that's necessarily a failing. No. I think it just means that you are not the specific niche target for this very specific style of what's happening.
Absolutely.
Like David Lynch's Inland Empire, for a lot of people, is a completely unwatchable movie, and I adore it. But I also love the music of Yoko Ono, and I'm not saying that as a joke. I adore Yoko Ono, and a lot of people cannot fathom that statement.
Yeah, I'll just say that's quite an interesting point of view, and the first person I've heard who ever said that.
Yeah, I was going to say that is the first time I've ever heard anybody say that.
I have seen her in concert. I listen to her music regularly.
Yeah, I have to say I've not really listened to her that much.
I was going to say I don't think I've ever listened to any, yeah. or like consciously sat and listened to any.
But I do think there is an element, certainly of in the UK, of kind of a sexism thing almost, where she was the woman who broke up the
Beatles. Yeah.
That's very common in the US too.
Yeah, she's the villain. Yeah. So you can just disregard everything she did. I guess that's still a thing.
I think it's a combination of factors. It's sexist. It's also, there's an element of racism happening there as well. But also, in addition to that, she was a fine artist, she was not a musician when she met John. And John just had her starting to record stuff before she had really done this stuff before and started releasing it. So also, you're hearing the music of like a person who's just starting to explore their creativity that normally would not be recorded yet. And it's being released to like a ginormous audience. And it wasn't refined enough yet.
Yeah.
But if you are curious, if you want to go on Spotify, there's an album called Approximately Infinite Universe. And if you're curious of what a Yoko Ono fan enjoys listening to, put that record on. You might love it, you might hate it, but it'll at least give you an idea as to what somebody who actually likes this enjoys about it.
Excellent.
Well, because a lot of the stuff that I listen to, other people don't class as music. I'm into really obscure industrial and all that experimental sort of stuff. So I'm going to give that a go.
Oh, yeah.
And I think in film terms, I think of things like Eraserhead as well. And that type
of movie,
you know. And I'm sure there's many other examples where that seems to me like a pure vision of the creator.
Yes.
And something you can put your own interpretations on, I guess, as well, which is perhaps another aspect of true art.
Yeah.
And then sometimes that the compromise doesn't work out well, like it did with Twin Peaks, because then you look at something like Dune, David Lynch's Dune, which is just a complete mess, but it was also... I think multiple directors were involved. And
I think that was the worst sin for a David Lynch film. It was just really dull. You know, that's something that you'd never think you'd say about David Lynch. You know,
have you seen the fan re-edit? Someone sort of re-edited it. I think it's up on YouTube. That's not bad. They rearranged the scenes and did some... I don't know if there were scenes that were cut out that they've put back in. It's totally unofficial, but it does... It's much more watchable.
Right.
But... yeah, not a patch on the recent, when was it, 2021, 22? The recent.
Yeah. And I'm going to lose all of my cred with this statement, but I've actually never read Dune. And I really need to.
I only read it about 2 or 3 years ago. So my wife's a big fan. That was the first time I'd read it. And yeah, it was okay. Not like for me, it wasn't. It's always held up as a sci-fi version of Lord of the Rings, I guess.
I think that's what turns me off. To be honest, it's just not my thing, my cup of tea at all. It's not pulpy enough for me.
So there we are. That's our first story of season two, and what an opening! What a great one to start with. Yep, we're covering the red world of Polaris next week, which is a return to Captain Vollmar, who we last saw jettisoning, abandoning crew members on Venus to die a horrible death.
Oh, yeah.
So we're looking forward to that. Thanks a lot, Jeff, for coming in and joining us again. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, this has been really fun. Thank you.
Do you have any... what have you got upcoming on Appendix N? You got any new projects coming up, or what are you covering over the next few episodes?
Yeah, well, we just recorded Fantasties by George MacDonald. I just started reading Kugel's Saga for the next one that we're going to be covering.
Excellent.
We are moving from a once every 2 weeks to once every 4 weeks schedule. After about 5 or 6 years of doing this, we're slowing down the pace a bit. But one thing that we're now doing instead is our patrons can still hang out with us every 2 weeks, because we're now having a patron movie club at the midway point. So for our first one, we're covering Joe D'Amato's The Blade Master.
Ah, nice.
For our second one, we're doing the Harryhausen Seven Voyages of Sinbad.
Mm.
And then for the third one, the poll has not been posted yet, but we'll be doing some kind of a Wes Craven film. So either Hills Have Eyes, A Nightmare on Elm Street, Scream, or Red Eye. I picked one movie from the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Right. So one of those four will be the third one that we will watch and discuss together.
That's a cool idea. We might have to pinch that, Tim, for the Innsmouth Book Club.
I like that. That's a good idea, yeah.
Okay, so thanks for listening, folks. That's it for today. We hope you can join us next time when we're shooting off into space again. I'd just like to quickly thank our patrons for all their support of the show. And if you'd like to join them, do check out our Patreon page. You get access to bonus content not only for Strange Shadows, but also the Innsmouth Book Club. You get regular copies of Innsmouth News and various other treats and bonuses. And I should also mention that patrons get free entry to our upcoming major event, September the 30th. We're running the Innsmouth Literary Festival in Bedford, UK. We've got Ramsey Campbell appearing on Zoom as a special guest. We've got various other authors, traders, gaming people there. It's going to be a very interesting day. Lots of stuff going on. So please do check that out. So big thanks again to Jeff. And with that, it's goodbye from me, Rob Poynton.
And it's goodbye from me, Tim Mendes.
Bye, everyone.